Good morning. As you probably know, April is Autism Awareness Month, but do you know the signs and where to go for help? The Central California Autism Center has some answers, and you'll hear what they're doing to bring awareness this month. And next, Heinz Hospice is gearing up for their Angel Babies Walk, how you can help the organization extend healing hands to families in mourning. And lastly, do you know the new laws taking effect this year? Our Fresno attorney has the news that you'll want to hear. Thanks for listening to Community Matters. I'm Kyra Jenkins. Now first, let's get started with Jenny Lee with the Central California Autism Center. Jenny, can you tell us about the events that you're planning?
Yes, we have annual events that we do to promote awareness on campus as well as in the general community.
Mm-hmm.
We have our Autism Awareness Field Day, which was on the 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
This is our fourth year doing partnership with the Grizzlies, where we have a strikeout autism game, and that game is on Sunday, the 10th.
There's a lot going on. So basically you're raising funds. Is it for research?
It's all-encompassing. Our main focus right now is to raise funds for a building, because there is a great need in the Central Valley, and there are many home service providers, but we are the only center-based service provider in the area.
Wow. And this is the Central California Autism Center, is it?
Yes.
Okay. So what is it like? You told me there's a huge waiting list where people are waiting to get on with their kids, bring them into the program.
Yes. We do field a lot of calls from parents that just basically need more information and don't even know what types of services are available to them. We are located at the university, and we are affiliated with the College of Math and Science. So if anything, what we want to do is be a hub of information for the community.
Yeah.
And even if we are unable to take them in as clients ourselves, we do just give out information and give them a first step. Hopefully it'll, if anything, just empower them to know that there is hope and there are people out there that can help.
But for those who are on the waiting list, or for those who think that their child may have autism, you guys do offer free screenings or different services, do you?
We do have a screening diagnostic day that we offer based on the people that call that are interested in we typically have them once a month, but we have had them up to three times in a month based on the need. And we do try to cater to all of the families. We understand the schedules. Trying to, bust the kids from home to soccer practice and then, the work schedule as well. So we try to accommodate that as best we can.
Wow. So that's pretty big that you guys want to buy a bigger building. How many more children would you take on in the program if you did?
Well, we obviously want to make sure that the standard and the quality of therapy is definitely at best practice and at a very high level. Right now we are sharing a space with the Huggins Center. They are so accommodating because we're taking over the space pretty much. If we were able to have a separate building, more like an institute where we could provide separate services more often for the community, and that would include servicing the children with autism, and then having sibling sessions where we bring in the siblings that aren't on the spectrum. We're able to show them how to interact with each other, as well as doing parent orientations. And we do parent community support groups, as well as teaching the parents how to interact with the children at home.
It seems like whenever I research autism centers, there's not many places that people can go to in Fresno. It looks like there's a couple places. I think Exceptional Parents Unlimited, they do screening. And then there's the Autism Center. So it looks like resources are limited. Is that right?
Well, there are many other service providers in the area, but we are the only center-based. The other service providers are mostly in-home services, in which the tutor or the therapist would be going into the family's homes. There's some comfort in that because it is your own home environment, but unfortunately, that means that one of the parents has to be a stay-at-home parent. So the benefits of having a center is it's an easier transition for the children when they do go into a typically developing school, or when they do start school, because they're used to being dropped off and then not having the parent there. So it's like going to school, and you drop off your child, then you pick them up at the certain time that they're done, and they're able to interact with other children. Whereas in a home-based situation, there might not be other children or another opportunity to socialize with other types of people and engage in that way.
So. Now, we were talking before the interview started about how just autism is just taking off at an alarming rate, how people are being diagnosed. So it's hard to really pinpoint a number to how many people have been diagnosed, but do you know any stats?
Yes, the current CDC statistics show that 1 in 110 children are diagnosed with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the rates just in the Central Valley have jumped something like 200%.
Wow.
That's almost a double-edged sword. The good thing about that is that there is awareness and the pediatricians are aware of the early symptoms and signs of autism, whereas before I don't think that there was very much information out there. So there's been a lot of misdiagnoses.
Yeah.
You know, especially with autism, early intervention is best. That's the plus.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other side of it is that it's jumping at alarming rates. And, unfortunately, there hasn't seemed to be a cause or a reason or, you know, we cannot pinpoint why some
people
children.
People keep speculating, though.
Yes.
Like we said, you know, we've heard diet and pesticides, just different studies that have been out there. But, yeah, I wanted to ask you, so what's the age of the children that are being treated at the center?
At the center, we currently have children as young as 18 months. And I believe our oldest client is 11 years
old.
How
do you diagnose someone who is like one and a half?
Well, there are some signs to look out for. Typically in young children, it'll be toe walking or not being able to babble.
Mm-hmm.
No vocalizations, as well as hand flapping and some other stemming type of behavior. If they tend to be sort of, I love the parents call and they describe their child as a loner.
Yeah.
And they're just totally content being off in a corner doing something by themselves and not really aware of other people and their surroundings.
Oh, okay.
That can also be a sign.
Gotcha. Now, I know that, just briefly to talk about it a little bit, that it's a wide spectrum of autism.
Yes.
It could be extreme to not extreme at all. So what's the worst case? You know, is it just autism? And in the least case, is that just Asperger's syndrome?
Autism is a spectrum disorder. And there I don't want to put a label on it where there's a worst and a best case scenario.
Okay.
You know, because no two people who are diagnosed with autism are alike in terms of their behaviors and how they might interact with others. But typically the higher functioning people who are diagnosed tend to be on the Asperger's side of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have lower functioning people who would need functional skills as well as just day-to-day assistance. And in that case, we try to just bring up quality of life to make sure that they're able to ask for water, they're able to go to the restroom, just to be able to say, you know, I'm hungry, those types of things, and interact with the parents and the rest of the community.
I was speaking with Dr. Amanda Adams, I think, a couple months ago, and I told her about my brother. He has Asperger's syndrome. And, you know, he's 14. He's getting older. I worry about him. I worry about, you know, if he'll be able to, you know, rent an apartment, if he'll be able to communicate to somebody and just hold a job, you know, in an interview. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, you know, what if a parent is listening to this and they have an older kid who has autism? Do you have any advice for that person?
We do have a program that is affiliated with the Autism Center, which is for older children. Currently, they have clients who are, I think 10 is the youngest, and they've also had clients who are in their 20s.
Huh.
So it's a social skills program, as well as a very short-term contracted service in which we focus on a specific behavior. I believe one of the clients, they just needed help with a job interview. We assessed what skills he was lacking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mostly it's obviously social skills and being able to read the cues and knowing when to say goodbye or maybe holding back certain comments and knowing when to engage and to back off and those types of things. So we do have that service available, and we have that information at the center. They can just call the main line as well.
Thanks, Jenny. Now back to the events coming up.
Yes.
So the 10th is a big day. You're telling me there's an event on the 10th?
Yes, we are having our fourth annual Strikeout Autism Grizzlies game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fundraiser that we've done with the Grizzlies, and they're big supporters of ours. Part of the ticket sales go to the center directly, and we also have other community service providers as well as nonprofit organizations that come out just to be able to raise awareness in the community as well as just disseminate information for families who might need more information about someone in their family who they suspect might be on the spectrum, or just a starting point. And it's also a good day for the families to come out and know that if their child has a little tantrum, it'll be okay, because we all know how that goes. And so it's a nice, comforting environment for the families to come out and just have a day out at the ballpark.
Yeah.
And just have some fun. So
the proceeds, they go towards the center, right?
Yes.
all of them, or?
Part of the ticket sales goes to the center. We always have a lot of fun.
And what time is that, and where is it? I've never been to a Grizzlies game. You have to forgive me.
Oh, no problem. The game's at Chauncey Park.
Okay.
It's 1800 Tulare Street. The game starts at 2:05. We always have a on-field autism awareness parade before the game starts.
Aww.
So if anybody in the community wants to come out and participate in that, they should be there at 1:00. And it's you just get to go around the field and be proud of your family member and raise awareness and
yeah.
And it's a great time, so everyone should come out. It's supposed to be gorgeous on Sunday too. I know it was raining earlier, but it's supposed to be sunny and warm.
No more rain. Is there anything else that people can do? Like, should we wear a certain color in support of autism or anything like that?
Well, currently the puzzle piece is the symbol for autism. Around campus, we've actually put around blue ribbons to signify that it's Autism Awareness Month,
mm-hmm.
and just to put out some statistics out there. But if people want to come out, y'all can wear blue or just wear whatever you want to wear as long as you're comfortable and just come out and support us. And we'll also have information about our third event, which is the golf tournament that we have, which is another fundraiser that we do, and that's our third year doing that.
And when's the golf tournament?
The golf tournament is going to be on Saturday, April 16th. And it will be at Eagle Springs Golf and Country Club.
April 16th. All right. I'll mark my calendar.
Yes, thank you. And they can just contact the center and ask for me, and I'll get them signed up and ready to go.
Now, there's a lot of events, you said. So for more information, there's a website, right?
Yes. It would be best to call us directly, though,
mm-hmm.
because they are coming up. They are very fast approaching. So the phone number to the center is 278-6773,
mm-hmm.
And our website address is www.ccac-fresnostate.org.
Now, I was wondering, what brings you the most success? If you're working around kids with autism, what makes you feel like relief? That's why I am the director of operations, as you are.
Well, my first sort of aha type of moment was when I was able to get a child to go pee-pee in the potty,
wow.
if you will. And I don't have any kids.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that I would be so excited. but I threw a party inside the building. And you know, there were students coming out, Fresno State students walking in and out of the hallways. And
mm-hmm.
they did not know what was going on. But That's a great accomplishment. And there are just situations where we're able to have a child say a vocalization.
Yeah.
And, you know, we let the parents know, oh, today they said ma. And, you know, they just start crying because
wow.
they've never even heard their child's voice before.
It's amazing.
So there's big, big moments that I think sometimes we all take for granted.
Mm.
Just little things, you know, just being able to give mommy a hug.
Wow.
We've had some parents that you know, they don't even know if their child knows them
wow.
or knows who they are. So it's there's lots of big moments.
It's amazing. I had one friend who worked with autistic kids, and she said that it was just so amazing. She worked with this one child for, I think, over a year. I think his name was Miles. And she said he's the only one who he will look at directly in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking to him. He'll look everywhere. But just that connection that they have, and that just melts her heart that he will look at her, because it takes so much practice, I'm sure.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that's another thing that is learned, you know, that I think people don't mm-hmm. necessarily understand. We
yeah.
we have to teach them to make eye contact and to mm-hmm. engage with us. So it's a great job, and it's a great center to be a part of.
Awesome. And so you said that you graduated from Fresno State.
Yes, I did. And then I just couldn't leave. So I just wanted to stay and be a part of the program still. So
I hope you come back and let us know of any other events. I know that autism exists outside of April. So
yes, yes, it does.
Any other events, let me know.
Yes, no, I definitely will. Thank you for having me.
And thank you. And can you give that number one last time? We'll sign off.
Yes, it's 278-6773.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
And now Sam Hsu joins us from Heinz Hospice here to tell us about a special event. But first, can you tell me about the organization?
Sure. Heinz Hospice is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to uphold the dignity and ease the suffering of the terminally ill while supporting their caregivers and those who are mourning. My position is Director of Fund Development and Communications, and I've been there just over 7 years.
So you have an event coming up. Can you tell me about the walk coming up?
Sure. This is our 7th annual Angel Babies Walk Run, and we created this walk to support our Angel Babies program, which provides support to families who have suffered a pregnancy or infant loss. It's a very unique program. There's only a handful of them in the state, and we are one of the few independent perinatal hospices. So we're very proud of that, to provide the service to our community.
So what will the walk be like? I mean, who's participating? How many people? Where is it at?
The walk's a lot of fun. It's going to be at Woodward Park again at the Mountain View Shelter. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of people who come out and walk in memory of their loved one, in memory of their baby. A lot of them form teams ranging from, you know, 3 people up to 75 people. And all of them, or most of them at least, do something to decorate their shirt and to identify themselves as part of that team, whether it's they order their own shirts or they decorate their shirts. A lot of people iron on photos of their baby onto the shirt. It's a pretty neat thing.
People, they don't have to have suffered a loss to participate in the walk, right?
Absolutely not. It's a fundraiser for the program, so anybody who has a heart for this cause is welcome to come out and support it. Oh, we're expecting, we need at least 100 volunteers to put the event on, but we're expecting about 1,200 people.
Wow, and so how do you get involved in this?
Well, they can visit our website at heinzhospice.org, or you can call our office at 559-320-0308 and get more information.
And can people show up on the day of the walk?
Absolutely. We do encourage people to pre-register, only because it is a little bit cheaper and they are guaranteed a race shirt.
Mm-hmm.
We don't guarantee shirts for late registrants, but we do take day of, and we do order some extras for people registering that day.
And so how does the funding work? How does it raise money for the organization?
Yeah, we get money through the registration and through sponsorships most of all. So we've got some wonderful sponsors who have supported us year after year, some new sponsors this year, which we're thrilled about. We've just been very blessed by the support of the community.
And so you say that Heinz Hospice, that it has basically 4 major events. What else is coming up other than this?
Yeah, throughout the year. This is our first one of the year. Then we're moving our Angel Babies Golf Tournament up, which also supports the Angel Babies program. That's going to be June 24th this year at Riverbend Golf Club. In September, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary of Heinz Hospice with a gala down at the Grand Ballroom downtown. Then in October 15th, actually, we're celebrating or honoring National Pregnancy and Infant Loss Day and the 10th anniversary of Angel Baby. So this is a big year for us with the 10th anniversary of Angel Babies and the 30th anniversary of the hospice. So we're having that ceremony in October, and then the first Wednesday in December each year, we hold our Lights of Love Memorial Tree Lighting Ceremony at River Park. Right. So we're pretty busy.
And so how did this get started? Is it a local organization or is it throughout the state?
Heinz Hospice started here locally with one hospice home in town in 1981. And we moved into our newer facility, our newer home in 1987. And then over the next few years, we expanded to serve patients in their own home on an outpatient basis in Fresno County. And then we expanded to Madera and Merced counties as well. So we've been serving all 3 counties now for a long time. We're seeing our average daily census is about 130 patients a day between the 3 counties. And our Angel Babies program just grew out of a necessity that these families were losing babies and they had no support. So Nancy had this vision to provide this, you know, program for them, and it's just grown tremendously. We've served over 2,500 families since we started in 2001.
What is the main function of the hospice? Does it offer support or therapy to parents? Or
mostly, we have our hospice home where we can see 6 patients, where we can care for 6 patients at a time around the clock. And these are terminally ill patients who have a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live. So we can care for them at the hospice home. We have 6 beds, as I said, and then we're seeing well over 100 patients in their own home just in Fresno County alone, Fresno Madera County alone, and then another 20-25 in Merced County. So our nursing staff, our chaplains, volunteers, social workers, and hospice aides go out to the home and visit the patients as needed. We care, we teach the families how to care for their loved one and visit as often or as little as they need us to.
And what's one of the most common diseases or sufferings that you see?
Well, a lot of people think, have a big misconception that we only take care of, quote, old people with cancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, while about 50% of our cases are cancer-related, the other 50% could be respiratory failure, just general dementia, general debility. There's a lot of other things that happen, heart disease, you know, a lot of other things that go on besides cancer that we care for. Our youngest patient was only hours old, and our oldest was 106. So we've served everything in between there.
Wow.
It's not just old people.
With cancer.
With cancer, exactly.
Different kind of things going on. You know, I heard this amazing story on a radio station when I was driving to work. It was the story of a mom who went to the hospital for her baby, and the doctor said, okay, your baby only has 24 hours to live. And she said, no, I'm faithful. I will take my baby home tomorrow. My baby will be okay. And the doctor thought she was crazy. She came the next day, and her baby was able to be checked out and able to go home. And
wow.
The doctor was just so in awe. He had tears in his eyes. He just could not believe that she was okay, because so many times parents are faithful and the opposite happens.
Exactly.
And I was wondering, do you ever hear any success stories, or do you ever hear just that people recover and they give back?
You know what? We do have patients who've, quote, graduated. Oh. They've graduated from hospice. Whether their disease goes into remission unexpectedly. We've had patients, one of them wanted to take a trip, and so we had to discharge her from hospice. And she never came back on, and that was 6 years ago, and she's doing fabulous.
Wow, that's so amazing.
So there are patients, you know, they really did have that diagnosis at one point, and the doctor really didn't think that they would make it, but mm-hmm. here they are years later. And they can always come back on at any time if they need us to.
And what about volunteers? Do you take just average people off the street who want to help?
Yes, we use volunteers in so many capacities. We couldn't do this work without them. We have over 300 volunteers, whether they are event volunteers that Lauren and I have at events like the walk, helping put that on, help plan it. Then we also have a big set of patient care volunteers who go into the home and maybe give that caregiver some respite so that they can go to the grocery store or take a nap or do something and just to sit with the patient. Mm-hmm. And then we also have clerical volunteers in the office who help prepare our mail, answer phones, do filing, that kind of thing.
And so how does funding work, and especially for the walk coming up too?
Mm-hmm. We rely on sponsorships and those registrations to make the money. Mm-hmm. The Angel Babies program in particular does not receive any reimbursement from insurance for the services provided to these families, whereas our hospice services are usually covered by Medicare or private insurance, or at least partially covered. The Angel Babies program receives no reimbursement, so it's 100% based on fundraising events and donations. So it's a crucial part of what we do.
Sam, I have to ask you, how did you get into this business? It just seems like it takes a certain person to work, you know, around this with babies.
Yeah. You know, it's a really special thing. And all of our staff, I'm in the office doing the fundraising, which I'm happy to do for these amazing team members who just have a heart for it. You have to love what you do, and they absolutely love it. And they feel blessed to get to go into these homes and take care of these families and these babies. It's a calling, and mm-hmm. you've got to have the calling to work there, and they do. They really consider it sacred work, mm-hmm. and they feel blessed to do it.
Wow. And so you say you started 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 2003, November 4th, 2003.
So did you start, you know, what position? How did you come on?
I was the fund development assistant, actually. And then when my boss left, I took her place as the director.
And then, Sam, one of my last questions, how is Heinz Hospice doing financially? Are there any needs for donations? Can the community help in other ways?
Yes, please. We always need donations. Yeah. We rely between 25 and 35% of our budget on donations. And our budget's over $9 million, if that gives you an idea.
Wow.
We have to raise over $2 million each year from our community just to remain operational. So, you know, with any kind of health care, it's just very expensive.
Yeah.
And we will go to the far corners of the counties, and we will take the patients that nobody else wants because they can't pay for them or because they're too complicated and will be too expensive. It doesn't mean that they don't deserve the quality care that we can give them. Mm. So I really feel like we go above and beyond what is expected of us.
Yeah.
And in taking that upon ourselves and our mission, we also take on the financial burden of that and have to rely on the community. And we've been very blessed for the last 30 years that the community has supported us so wholeheartedly.
And so how does a parent get help from Heinz Hospice? Do they have to have insurance, or how does that
mm-hmm.
work?
If they want to call our Angel Babies program specifically, they can give us a call at 559-248-8579, and one of the representatives from Angel Babies can help them. Or they can also visit our website at heinzhospice.org and click on the Angel Babies link. There's some really helpful resources up there. Or our Facebook page. There's a lot of helpful stuff going on there.
Now, while the organization is treating babies, what kind of services are there for parents who are suffering mm-hmm. through this?
We offer one-on-one counseling, family counseling, couples. We also have group counseling. We have two 12-week sessions throughout the year and then an 8-week session over the summer. And these are in a group setting where you're with other parents who've experienced very similar loss mm-hmm. and can help you through it. and things like that. This Angel Babies Walk, it's a really neat thing to see the families who their loss is very recent find support in the families who it may have been a few years, and they can find support in them and see that their lives have gone on. And, you know, that they've survived it. It gives them hope for the future themselves.
Just to come back to this walk, it's on May 7th, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so how far will volunteers be walking around Woodward Park?
Well, the participants, there's a 2-mile walk, and then there's a 5K, which is 3.2 miles, I believe. Oh. So then we've got our volunteers staggered throughout the course, monitoring that. And then at the breakfast station, the kids zone, we've got volunteers everywhere. But there's always going to be somebody there to help our participants, so...
Great. I'm excited. It sounds really
good. It's very neat.
Hope it's a success again.
Thank you very much. We just couldn't thank Clear Channel enough. You guys have always been so supportive of this. And Brady and Rose come out every year and walk. And it's just been a really neat partnership. So thank you guys.
Are you guys looking to top, you know, numbers from last year or participants from last year, anything like that?
I'd like to hit $40,000 this year. I'd like for us to raise that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first year we were hoping to make a few thousand, and we made 27.
Whoa.
And we've been steadily, you know, going up. And every year, you know, it gets a little bit tougher with this economy the way it is. And we understand it's difficult for people, but we appreciate every dollar. So we're really hoping to hit that milestone on our 10th anniversary.
And so what's the website one more time?
www.heinzhospice.org.
All right. Well, Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And lastly, attorney David Muggeridge is here to talk about a few new laws for 2011. But first, tell us about yourself, David. What kind of law do you specialize in?
I'm actually a certified criminal law specialist by the State Bar, California.
Okay. And how long have you been practicing in Fresno?
Since 1985, I graduated from San Joaquin College of Law.
And how do you like it so far? I know it's been like, what,
25? Oh, I love it. You know, it's very fulfilling. It's kind of a dream for me to be able to be out there and be independent and be on my own. And that's one of the great things that I found about San Joaquin. It gave me mm-hmm. the opportunity to start all over again and create a new field to go into. And I'm just so appreciative that I had that opportunity.
Well, we're here to talk about some laws taking effect this year that people should know about. What's one of the most top interesting laws that people should know that is taking effect this year?
Well, there's a new bill that was signed into law, Senate Bill 183, that affects just about everybody in California. The governor in May of last year signed this bill that requires anybody that has rental home or rental apartments that have any kind of fossil fuel burning units in their residence to have a carbon monoxide detector in the house.
Uh-huh.
And then as of 2013, January, every home in California will be required to have one in their house. The law at this point is applied only to existing rental properties and any time you transfer ownership of properties.
Okay, so basically if someone is looking for an apartment, the apartment should come with a detector.
At this point, as of right now, the law requires apartment complexes to have existing operational carbon monoxide detectors in there.
And that's for good reason. I remember what happened in Oakhurst a couple months ago.
The stats were pretty amazing. There were over 1,000 people in California that have recently been affected, that were killed by carbon monoxide poisoning due to leaky heaters and that kind of thing. And legislation was designed to protect us from ourselves, I guess. Most people don't really think that it's a very significant thing.
Right.
It's the same thing like radon, the radon that exists out there in the house. And I can see you're kind of speculative right now. What is radon? Radon is a gas byproduct, if you will.
Okay.
That the earth kind of produces. I'm not a chemist or a scientist.
Right.
But I know that when the sun's rays hit the earth and warm the earth, it can produce this gaseous byproduct, and that can come up through the dirt and come up through the floors in houses and can, not quite as easily as carbon monoxide, but it can harm people over a period of time. Carbon monoxide is a little quicker. It's a lot more commonly heard of. I think it'd be a little bit more difficult to find the significant stats in the number of deaths that from radon compared to carbon monoxide. The reason why it's called a silent killer is you don't smell it. So it's not as if you would know, you know, what is that smell, and then you'd get up from your chair and you'd go look to see if something was leaking. You just don't know it, and it overpowers you before you know what's happening, and you pass out. And if you don't get fresh air right away, you're sleeping forever.
And Oakhurst, they were saying that four family members, they basically just did not wake up.
Right.
So what causes carbon monoxide poisoning? I don't know if you know, but I understand that the generator, basically the fumes weren't going outside. They were going inside. So if someone is using a generator, there's a risk?
Well, it's if you have an all-electrical house, the law doesn't affect you. Okay? It's only when you have a carbon fuel-based product of some kind. You've got a generator, you've got a car, you've got a water heater, you've got a gas log in a fireplace. Anything that produces gas that has a flame, therefore gives off some type of an emission from this that's capable of producing the carbon monoxide. That requires the detector. But like I said, we're bringing it in pieces. It's not everybody all at once.
Right.
We're starting with the rental properties and any transfers of existing property to somebody else that has those already in there.
Now, just to get back to these laws before we wrap up here. So understand that whooping cough, that's a law.
That's right.
Did you see that? That by July, I think all teens have to be vaccinated for that.
And, you know, again, that's a question of how far do we want government to help us? Aren't we responsible for getting our own kids vaccinated? Well, to a certain extent, we understand with that. But the people who passed that law looked at it a different way. Every time a parent doesn't get their kids vaccinated and they get whooping cough and they have no medical insurance, where do they go for treatment? They go to the county hospital. Who pays for that? The citizens of that county. So it's costing us money, and therefore the government gets involved and says, for our own benefit, we're going to make this law and we're going to require it. Sometimes the people get the opportunity to really discuss and debate that.
Yeah.
And other times the decision is made by the government.
And then lastly, you know, I read about the American Academy of Pediatrics. They're saying that now kids until two, they should face the rear in car seats. What do you think about that? Can a state or legislatures really impose that? Of course they can. But do you think, what's the chance of that becoming a law?
I think it's a very good chance of becoming law. Anytime you have laws that relate to child health and welfare, they're a lot more likely to get passed regardless of the financial impact on families. In fact, what they've done to try to mitigate that is that they will often go out in various communities and they will offer free child seat to the families that can't afford to buy them. That's how concerned they are to get that law out there to protect kids.
But my son is one, and when he turned one, David, we were so excited. He can, you know, face like everyone else in the car. Now this policy came out this week, and we're like, do we really want to turn him around? But it looks like that the death rate decreases.
Oh, it has a dramatic impact on the injuries to little kids. There's no question about it. Putting them in the seat, rear-facing. In fact, perhaps a lot of us would do better in the rear seat, you know, facing backwards. I could tell my wife who's coming up on us.
We'll try that one. And then my last question, community state. Okay, I heard California's a community state. My husband and I, we bought a house. His credit was better than mine. There's a lot of cases like this. So it went under his name. And I was thinking, well, geez, I really want the house under my name, too. I want my credit to, you know, get a boost. But my the realtor said, well, you know, Kyra, if he dies or something happens, we're a community state, you'll get the house.
Yes,
what does that mean, community state?
California is what they call a community property state.
Okay.
And it's another form of the many forms that exist for holding property. And basically what it means is that a husband and wife who acquire property during their marriage develop an interest in that property. Even if the deed says it's bought by John Smith as his sole and separate property, if the attorneys can prove with the evidence that even though the deed says it's John's, if you can show that actually he didn't own it before the marriage, but he bought it during the marriage and he used some of his salary to buy that property, then the wife has an interest in the property. She's entitled to it. Now, if he uses his grandmother's gift to him and he buys the property and he buys it 100%, then the spouse probably doesn't get an interest in the property.
Pleasure. And that brought up my last question about the squatter's law. These things just keep coming. Have you heard about that law, squatter's law?
There are laws in states. They talk about owning or becoming a possessor of property because you're a squatter, okay?
Yeah.
And a squatter basically is somebody who sits on property, and over a period of time, depending on the state that you're in, you could acquire ownership of the property. You could have a right to own, maintain, keep, do whatever you want to with a property if, and some states have two requirements, if you're there for a certain period of time and you pay taxes. So you got to be careful. There's got to be the right number of years, okay, depending on the state, mm-hmm, and you got to pay taxes. I don't believe that California requires the payment of taxes, but they do require a certain number of years.
Very interesting. When we bought our house, there's about 2 acres outside of our house extending past the fence. So we were thinking about that. But I think that would be foolish, because what if we were paying taxes? I think, and then all of a sudden someone comes, we have lost out on that.
Well, there's a piece of property that's being disputed right now in the Sequoia National Forest. It was in the paper today. A individual bought a piece of property. I think it was actually up there near Hume Lake. And they paid a good fee for the property. And then it was discovered later on that the deed was defective, and they weren't actually buying what they thought that they were buying. And then the question became, well, who owned the property, the original seller or the new buyer? The title company that helped prepare the deed didn't check it out properly, and it's become a real mess. It's going to end up in the courts right now. Who owns it?
Sounds like a mess.
It is a real mess. You got to make sure you pick a good title company.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Any other laws? What else do you have in the bag?
A lot of the laws that were out there that are still on the books were very well intended. The government really intended to do certain things for us to make sure that we were protected basically from ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't do as quite a good job as taking them off the books after they're no longer necessary as we do in putting them on the books.
Yeah.
So, for example, today it's illegal in Hollywood, unless you have a special permit, to have a parade of more than 50 sheep on the streets in Hollywood.
No sheep.
No sheep as well if there's more than 50. Now, I've given you a list. There's a whole bunch of very, very interesting things that are out there, and people would be amazed.
You can't cry on the witness stand in L.A.
You cannot cry on the witness stand in L.A.
I'm opposed to that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would find...
I cry all
the time. Yeah, we'd cry all the time. That'd be a hard problem for many of us.
Let's see. What were some of the most outrageous ones that you saw still in the book?
There's some hilarious ones, but they were serious when they were first instituted. I mean, for example, there's one about you can't spit within 5 feet of somebody, and nobody ever bothered to follow up on it, so it's still there.
Wow.
I think one of the ones in Norco is, I believe, that says if you're going to parade with an elephant, you have to have it on a leash.
In San Francisco, it says it is illegal to wipe one's car with used underwear.
Underwear, yeah.
Now, they can be clean, but if they're used... That's a problem.
And who's going to check up on that? You know, who's going to be the investigator who wants to find that out?
I don't think anyone's going to do that.
I think in Santa Ana, it is illegal to have a pile of horse manure that's more than 5 feet deep.
Give horses a break. I mean, can they?
They've
got to
do it somewhere.
Measure?
Yeah, you know, if not out in the country.
Another one that I wanted to mention, it says males may not dress as females unless a special permit is obtained by the sheriff. That's in Walnut.
And you would have thought so close to the Bay Area that would be something that we wouldn't see there out of sensitivity for those of that last
life.
Now, actually, in California, another serious law that has now been in effect, so we've seen the evidence of what it's done for us in the criminal court system, is something called deferred entry of judgment. Basically allows the judges to wait and give an individual who's been brought before the court for a criminal offense, before they ultimately sentence him and impose a punishment or a penalty, they put him on probation for a period of time, see how he or she does. If they fulfill certain conditions during that period of time, for example, they may have a drug problem or a alcohol problem, and they say, okay, we'll put you on the deferred entry of judgment. We're going to ask that you take some classes, and if you do well, okay, then the deferred entry of judgment allows us to essentially wipe out your plea and bring you back to zero so you don't have a conviction. It's a very successful program, and it, you know, of course, it saves money for the taxpayers eventually if you're able to do that, and it gives people something to work for. If I am a good guy for a year and I can prove to the court that I haven't done anything wrong, then I get to wipe out the impact of the crime that I committed. So everybody wins.
This is just when there is substance abuse involved.
No, not in substance abuse only, mostly, but it's not limited to that. For example, you can get a deferred entry of judgment, for example, in a petty theft, and they require people to go out and take theft classes. If everybody's out there stealing things off of shelves, the price of the goods goes up. So we all benefit.
Yeah.
And when you put an offender out there and you require them to take a class, they start learning a little bit more to the extent that they can about the impact that their small little crime may have on society. Cost of punishing these people goes down. The cost of enforcing the crimes goes down. Everybody's made better for it.
And David, I wanted to ask you, is this three strikes law still in effect in California?
The three strikes law is still in effect in California, and there is as much controversy today.
Yes.
As there was when it went in. A couple of the major areas that the three strikes controversy still surrounds is we had thought, or it had been argued by the proponents of three strikes law, that if you started holding people even more accountable mm-hmm. by the three strikes law, people would be afraid, and if I get another crime, if I commit another strike, I'm going to go away to prison forever. And that isn't changing. But it has had one other impact that a lot of the opponents presumed that it was going to have, and that is the population in the prisons has skyrocketed because of the three strikes laws. We have more people that are going into California prisons. We have one of the highest incarceration rates, not just in the United States, but in the world.
Really?
We're one of the highest out there in terms of the percentage of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, now with California in the financial crisis that we're at, again, it's a question of we've got to take a look at it, and is that where we want to spend our money? Is that how we want to spend our money? Now, I'm not a social democrat, but it does seem to me, and I know a lot of other people feel the same way, if you can help some of these people that are otherwise out there committing crimes for whatever reason, and it reduces the ultimate number of or the percentage of crimes that are being committed in California, again, everybody's a winner. We essentially can't lock everybody up just because they're committing some kind of a crime, or a good portion of the population would be in custody. How many people that are out there listening to your program right now can honestly say they've never run, say, an orange light, kind of red?
Yeah.
You know?
But three strikes is a bit excessive.
Oh, there's no question about it.
On the opposite side of the fence.
Right. And that raises the other issue that's
right.
being attacked. What is the new triggering event? In other words, what kind of a crime do we want the last crime in the stack, if you will, the third strike, to be in order to impose three strikes? In Fresno County, I had the first three strikes case a long time ago, and it was in front of now federal court Judge Larry O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a young man that was accused of stealing a broken weed eater. They later found him and recovered the stolen weed eater that was probably worth, $5 at a yard sale.
Wow.
And at that time, there was only one reported case. It was from the day we know for a fact that under a case called People v. Romero, the Superior Court still has the power to say, I'm going to strike a couple of the prior strikes so that the what we call draconian, the huge imposition, the serious consequences of this third strike doesn't hit somebody as bad. So they're able to look at things like how long ago were the first two strikes? How serious were those two crimes? How significant was the impact on the victims?
Mm-hmm.
What has the defendant's life been since then? Were the two strikes, 20 years ago, and he got caught twice for petty theft, and now he's got petty theft with a prior, which is a felony.
Wow.
Things like that are being looked at a little bit more critically now, and people are starting to, again, question and evaluate whether or not we want to tweak, if you will, the three strikes law just a little bit, so it won't have quite the impact that some of us hoped that it wouldn't have, and we're finding that it does have now.
That's what it sounds like. And where does California stand with the death sentence? I know that we are pro-death sentence.
Well, right now, California is second only to Texas.
I was going
to
guess Texas.
It is. Texas, and then New York, I believe, is third in the number of people on death row. The California system was put into abeyance for a while because there was a federal court judge that was questioning whether or not the method, the chemical composition of the drugs that was being used to execute people was the most effective and yet the most pain-free, if you can believe it, that was the concern, the most pain-free to the inmate that was being executed. California went back, they reformulated the chemicals, they did some tinkering, I guess, with the equipment as well, where the executions would take place. And I think we will soon see executions continuing at a greater pace now because there are more people on death row who have now exhausted various appeals and writ procedures they were in, and now the method has been approved. And I think that the citizens of California are going to be squarely faced with a new reputation of being one of the states with the greatest number of death penalty executions compared to anybody else.
Oh my gosh. So do we hear about it every time that someone is executed?
Well, it's been on hold, so it hasn't been in everybody's front and center. Mm-hmm. I don't think people were necessarily discussing it except those that were in the criminal law system, attorneys and on both sides, mm-hmm. And the courts, obviously, and senators and congressmen and such. But it's something that we won't be able to get away from for very long, because every time there's an execution, mm-hmm. the media does cover it. And we'll hear about that. Talking about money today is something we can't get away from, particularly in government, because it has been shown that it is cheaper to actually put somebody into prison for life than it is to execute them.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow.
That's a fact that nobody has really disputed.
Argument.
No. No, it isn't. It is cheaper to put somebody in prison for life. I think the figure right now they're saying is about anywhere from $26,000 to $32,000 a year to keep them in prison, compared to the couple hundred thousand. Actually, it's more than that. It's more closer to a million that it eventually costs to execute somebody because of the cost of the court system appealing and filing the writs and going through that, plus the time that the individual is in custody until that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may change if the executions speed up and people aren't alive in the prison system as long. But even if the executions speed up, you're still going to have this appellate process that takes anywhere from 12 to 15 years for most of these cases to be heard, and then some of them longer than that. Mm-hmm. And the average right now before a person who's received the death penalty, before they even get a lawyer appointed to look at their case, is about 3.5 years. So from the time they get the death penalty imposed mm-hmm. on them, they're sitting in prison somewhere for 3.5 years, and nothing is happening. And maybe that's, if people want to get upset about it, that's maybe where we should go. If you want to speed up the system, make it possible for a greater number of attorneys to take on some of these cases. But mm-hmm. right now, that's a major problem, finding qualified attorneys as quickly as possible mm-hmm. Who the court will appoint to do a death penalty case.
And David, last question about death penalty. What merits a death sentence? Is it just a mass killing, or could it be just one?
There are a number of reasons why the death penalty is authorized under California law,
mm-hmm.
And they reach anywhere from the commission of a crime during the course of torture, for example,
okay.
Or by bombing someone, or by killing multiple victims. There's a whole host of, mm-hmm. of factors that are out there that the courts, or actually that the district attorney's office, can use initially to decide, is this the kind of a case that we think merits the death penalty? Because special circumstances, which is what you're really looking at here, special circumstances allows the district attorney to ask either for life without the possibility of parole
mm-hmm.
or the death penalty. And there are special circumstances cases being filed all over the state of California, but there are counties that don't seek the death penalty. For example, mm-hmm. Humboldt County, and I remember this back in, at least since I was there in 85, nobody up there could remember it being done recently up there.
Mm-hmm.
They just decided as a matter of finances,
wow.
they were happy with putting somebody away for life in a small concrete 10-by-10 room and letting them stay there. So they have not sought the death penalty. And, you know, when you have all these counties that are talking about the money shortages and the burdens,
mm-hmm.
ask Humboldt County how many problems they've had in that regard because of the savings they've made in not seeking the death penalty.
That I didn't know that individual counties had their own power, but of course it makes sense. So speaking of finances and the state, you know where this is headed. How long does it take to put an initiative on the ballot if you gather signatures? I heard that the governor, that he wanted to start gathering signatures to put the tax hike extension on the ballot.
Well, you know, it depends on how big of a group that you have, because you've only got so much time before the next election period is going to come up, and you have to have the votes that are certified well in advance of the election itself. And that means if you've got a lot of people that are out there working in the grassroots to go mm-hmm. out there with the ballots and collect the signatures, it's not as difficult. But if you've got a relatively unknown or perhaps unpopular law that you want to try to get passed, it's going to be difficult to find people to go out there and seek votes, and it's going to be difficult to get people to be willing to sign the votes. So they may not be able to do it quickly because it's going to take them, you know, a couple of years rather than a couple of months to get enough support to even get it on the ballot to begin with.
And, you know, David, I even wonder how successful people are when they petition. You know, when you walk into the grocery store, hey, can you just sign this, you know, for the DMV charge to decrease it? Or can you sign this for the GI Bill for the military vets, whatever? I just wonder how successful is that? You know, you write down your address and your name, but sometimes you don't hear about it again.
And I think that's because there's probably less than half that people are pushing out there that actually make it that far. A lot of well-intentioned people, but they run out of steam when they run out of money and they don't have volunteers.
How's the law industry doing, recovering from the recession?
In my field, in criminal law, the cases have not slowed down at all. In fact, if anything, they have sadly increased. There's a lot of people that are out there committing crimes of opportunity that are desperate because they don't have any money, they don't have any assets, they don't have any work, they don't have any hope of work because they've got no skills, no education, no training. And then there are a number of people that are we've always had around, the people that are addicts of one kind or another. And again, with them, it's more a crime of opportunity than it is a crime of planning. That's different than when you talk about people that are more like a career criminal that think about crimes ahead of time and plan them out well. In downtimes like we have right now, you've got a lot more crimes of opportunity of desperate people that are out there and they see no other way to help themselves other than to commit a crime. And they'll go into a store and they'll steal something from the store. You know, there's a difference, too, in the nature of the crime. What's the difference between a young man who goes into a store and steals a loaf of bread because he's hungry versus a young lady that goes into a store and steals a piece of jewelry because she thinks it's pretty? Is there a difference there? You know, maybe that's only moral and that's not legal. It's certainly they're both criminal acts. But I think we could perhaps understand one.
The first one, yeah.
Yeah, versus the other one when you're simply stealing jewelry because it's pretty.
And I can barely understand the first one because we have the food bank, we have, you know, Salvation Army, different places offering food, but I guess in extreme cases.
Well, it's true, getting around, though, to get to the food bank. You know, a lot of our probably most of our homeless don't have cars.
But, you know, something that really intrigued me was last week when I heard about those men who came from SoCal to rob that NICTEC cashing place. It was not bizarre. It sounds like it was premeditated. Let's go to Fresno and let's just rob this place.
I would suspect that they have something of a record, and that because if they'd have done that down in their hometown, they were probably well known.
Yeah.
And so they figured, well, I got to go to a place where somebody hasn't seen me before, and then I got a better chance of committing the crime. But they must have also had some idea, you know, why pick Fresno?
Why
not Reedley or Visalia or, you know, God knows where? They came to Fresno. Maybe there's a connection here to some family or friend, you know, that they have
up
here.
That's what I keep hearing people say.
Yeah.
I'm following that case, though, with Leonard Jackson.
Interesting.
We just see what happens. And one of my last questions, what is the difference between murder and manslaughter? You know, sometimes in news we just throw out, oh, he's facing murder charges.
Right.
But is he really facing murder charges?
Right.
What's the difference?
The real simple, that's a whole semester course, but real simply, murder requires a particular state of mind that we call malice, okay? Now, malice is sometimes expressed when they say, and you've seen it on the TV, you know, I'm going to kill you, okay? That's expressed malice.
Okay.
You know he's going to do something, and he's going to kill somebody because he makes it easiest for us to see that when he says, I'm going to kill you. On the other hand, when somebody walks out into their backyard and they are at a party and they start drinking beer and they've had five or six cans of Budweiser or something, and one of the trains from the Central Valley goes by their backyard, and they take their gun out and they just shoot into the moving train, not intending necessarily to hit somebody.
Yeah.
So we can't say that they have that evil mind, that malice.
Okay.
But the intent is inferred from the action, okay? Now, sometimes we can say that because of the state of mind that they have no malice at all, expressed or implied. For example, you take a case where somebody is drunk, and if they are truly, truly drunk, or they're in what's called a heat of passion, where they're not thinking about it. They come home, they walk into their bedroom, And it's the old thing you've heard about, oh, my God, here's my wife, having an affair with
someone
my best
else.
Friend. Mm-hmm. So I pull out my gun from, you know, the bedroom closet, and I shoot him while I'm in this heat of passion. Mm-hmm. That's not premeditated. It happened under great stress, mm-hmm. probably not likely to occur again.
Yeah.
That's the case where you're more likely to see somebody getting a case of manslaughter.
So manslaughter can be the result of an action, like that guy just throwing a fire, maybe 4th of July, whatever,
right.
Someone can die. Or even, like you said,
right.
heat of passion.
Right. And I mean, I aimed the gun at so-and-so. We're not saying that I didn't have that intent to yeah. kill him, but my mind was so overcome by the emotional situation and the death resulted. That's manslaughter.
Okay. David, I have a moral question for you. Do you believe that all people who commit murder are kind of insane? Or do you think some people are just evil?
I have had clients before that caused me to wonder whether or not there was a difference between being insane versus just being evil. I've had a couple of those clients during my life. So I would have to say I've had some people at times which really makes me believe that there is evil in the world. And that some people are kind of the poster child for evil. But that's rare.
Now, I want to talk more about you before we sign off.
Sure.
Now, you have your own law company. How did this get started?
Actually, I was the law clerk and the research attorney for the presiding justice at the Court of Appeals, Justice George Brown,
mm-hmm.
the last 2 years that he was in charge of the court over there. And actually, if he had decided never to retire, I'd have been there with him today because I love the man dearly, and it was an absolute fascinating opportunity to work for the Court of Appeals.
Hmm.
But I soon decided after that I had worked too long and given up too much that I wanted to have my own practice. So I went out and opened up a practice beginning in 1988.
Okay.
And I have practiced originally personal injury and criminal law, and now I'm a certified specialist, and all I do is criminal law, both in the trial court and in the appellate court. And I was actually thrilled because, you know, I thought I had gotten just about everything I wanted out of life and accomplished what I want. And then last year, for some reason, I was named a California super lawyer for criminal lawyers. And this year again, it's happened again. Somebody thought that I've done something right, and I've been named again for criminal law California super lawyer. So
wow.
I'm just having a great time. I enjoy the practice of law. I enjoy trying to help people because I think that we all sometimes will get into trouble, some of us in criminal problems, some of us in civil problems.
What do you love the most about teaching at San Joaquin College of Law?
The thing that I love most about teaching is the interaction between the faculty and the students. And I love working with people, particularly in the area of writing, which is what I teach. I teach over at Fresno Pacific every couple of years. I teach a course on basic principles of American jurisprudence. The ability to get into a classroom to work with a young mind is something that an old mind appreciates.
Anything else you wanted to add?
Thank you for the opportunity. Get me the chance to look up these weird laws again in California. Do you have one last one you want to close on?
Drinking intoxicating cement.
Now, who would have thought about drinking intoxicating cement? Is illegal? What's illegal?
Indian Wells.
Indian Wells. Well, it's got to be out in the desert. Maybe there's not a lot going on.
David, I'm sorry. I have to mention this one in L.A. It says, it's a crime for dogs to mate 500 yards of a church.
Well, that should be. I mean, they should respect churches. You know, there's got to be a limit somewhere.
Some class.
We draw the
dogs. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
If you missed our discussion on autism awareness, the Angel Babies Walk, or new laws, you can find Community Matters online. Just go to the station's website and look under features or extras. You can also find us on Facebook under Clear Channel Fresno Community Matters. Next week, we'll speak with Mike Dozier from the Fresno Jobs Initiative on job trends and clean energy jobs. And if you know of a great organization or someone helping those in the community, be sure to tell me about it at KyraJenkins@clearchannel.com, or you can call me at 230-4200, 230-4200.